from New York City. It's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. I'm on the road, and I'm hopefully the last time I'll be on the phone, so we don't have quite the technical professionalism that we normally would have when I'm in a mic room and or on the road with Comrex. But we have so much today. The latest, of course, on health and nutrition. Yesterday we had good feedback on the questions. We're going to talk about blueberries today. A study out of Florida State University shows they really are good for us, but what exactly do they do? Also, we're going to explore the understanding how to get your blood cells to live a longer life, especially if you're postmenopausal women, because a lot of women have an advantage in living longer and being healthier up till menopause, and then, boy, it goes out the window, and they actually die quicker. And they don't have any symptoms before they have a heart attack or stroke. They just die. So we're going to try to do something about that. University of Cincinnati will help us. And what happens if you have an elevated homocysteine level? That's not good. I'll show you how to lower it and save a heart attack or stroke from happening. So in the area of health and nutrition, we always try to bring you the latest and the best insights and information, and that's what we're doing today. Now, we also have a guest in the second part of our program, and he is an interesting individual. He is a former CIA analyst who saw corruption in the agency, and he told a reporter about it, and for that, he went to jail. So I'm going to be asking him a simple question. You went to jail because you felt outrage at the injustice, the criminality that the United States government was expanding on. What happened because of that? Was there any change anywhere? Were you just a person that they brushed off the pages of the news, put you in prison, adversely affected your whole life and your future and reputation, but nothing changes? What does that tell us? We'll discuss that with Mr. Kawakawa. Also a commentary today from Chris Hedges from Truth Dig, The Dance of Death. Also today, I'm going to ask the audience to call in and share their thoughts on this issue, and that is microchipping humans. First, you trade your freedom for security. That's where we've been ever since 9/11. And that's why when I talk about asset forfeiture, billions of dollars a year, more than organized crime and burglaries, nobody cares. And then when I talk about global warming, and I will be doing that today, showing you what has happened in the last 24 hours and around the world, nobody cares. And then now they're going to be editing the human genes. Well, that they do care about if they can afford to have their baby with all kinds of wonderful designer genes. Well, here's a question. What has happened in the last 30 years to parents, meaning the baby boomers, my generation, and their children, the X generation, and then their children, the Y and millennial generation, when we just wanted better and better and better and better? And so we gave them private tutors and coaches and unlimited amounts of money they could spend on nothing and wasteful products and never have to be conscious of anything in their life, because there was always someone at Daddy Warbucks to come in and get them out of a jam. So now we're going to add something on top of that. We're going to design them to be stronger, brighter, more obedient to authority. Wow. And again, we're not even having a discussion on this. So we will. So we're going to bring you all that today. And we always start with the latest on health and healing. And today there's a good study on blueberries. Why? Because blueberries are showing themselves to be one of the top superfoods that we can put into our body. Now, you can eat them fresh and organic. That's good. You can get the concentrate, which is good, or a powder. It's all good. And here's what they're showing. It can help prevent heart disease. The power of healthy nutrition In this study, conducted in postmenopausal women, women who've gone through menopause, showed that as little as one cup of blueberries a day reduced the risk of cardiovascular disease by lowering the blood pressure and reversing arterial stiffness. Wow. That is big-time healing. The study was published in the Journal of the American Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. It was a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled study, and that's the gold standard in science, and it was conducted in these postmenopausal women who were at a greater risk of heart disease and have higher incidence of hypertension and arterial stiffness. And so they were able to reverse this, and that was just with 22 grams. By the way, it takes 20.35 grams to be an ounce, so that's under an ounce of powder. And so it made a big difference. So women, postmenopausal women, eat at least a cup of blueberries a day. Now, separately, in a different article published in the Preview Journal Circulation, blueberries and strawberries together decreased heart attack risk by up to 33%. So that's good also. And then there is another measurement called ORAC. ORAC stands for Oxygen Radical Absorbance Capacity. And ORAC is important. I'm going to guess the average American gets somewhere between 200 to 500 ORAC a day. One cup of blueberries contains 9,621 ORAC, which makes it one of the most antioxidant-rich foods on the face of the earth. So that means it's anti-inflammatory, neuroprotective, and anti-cancer. And also, they're one of the most nutrient-dense foods, with each berry packed with an amazing array of vitamins, minerals, polyphenols, vitamin K, fiber, manganese, vitamin C. It's really good. So I can't say enough. And also, it has quercetin, Q-U-E-R-C-E-T-I-N, quercetin. And it has resveratrol, res, R-E-S, vera, V-E-R, A, trol, T-R-O-L, resveratrol. It's been studied for its cancer-fighting, cardioprotective, and life-promoting and anti-aging benefits. So my nutrient of the day is a food loaded with the best of the best, and that's blueberries. Now, men and women respond differently to disease and treatments for biological, social, and psychological reasons. And in a series on gender medicine, experts explored the difference and the importance of approaching treatment and diagnosis through a gender lens. And we know that sex hormones drive characteristic male and female traits, such as breast enlargement or hip widening in women, or an increased muscle mass and growth of facial hair in men. But now we also recognize they have a major impact upon the immune system, which is our body's built-in mechanism that helps fight and protect us against disease. Research suggests this has an evolutionary basis, meaning survival of the species may mean men are harder hit by viruses, but a woman's reactive capacity is also a part of her immune system. It leaves her more susceptible to autoimmune diseases and allergies. And when men die significantly more often from infectious disease than women, for instance, men are over 150% more likely to die from tuberculosis and 200% more likely to die of Hodgkin's lymphoma following Epstein-Barr virus infection. Men are also 500% more likely to develop cancer after infection with human papillomavirus than women. And this is because women's immune systems mount a stronger response against foreign invaders, particularly viruses. And while the male hormone testosterone tends to dampen immune responses, the female hormone estrogen increases the number of immune cells and the intensity of their response, so women are able to recover more quickly from an infection. And all this may reflect a kind of sneaky evolutionary trick used by viruses to evade their enable their survival. Women have developed multiple mechanisms to transmit infections, mainly through passing bugs from mother to child during gestation or birth, and through breastfeeding. So women are better vessels for viruses. Meanwhile, viruses have signaled men out as a weaker sex. And while popular cultures come up with the term man flu, suggesting men are over-dramatizing flu symptoms, evidence suggests they may in reality be suffering more due to this dampening down of their immune responses. So in lay language, this means this, that no matter what your social position has been, your body is evolutionary. And that makes men and women allergic to different things for different reasons, and their immune response different as well. So both men and women should be focused upon your immune system. Your immune system is what keeps you alive, keeps these viruses, bacteria, parasites, these germs from causing you to become really sick or dying. Do you realize how many people's immune system is destroyed by simple things? Antibiotics destroy the immune system. Pregnenolone destroys the immune system. Chemotherapy destroys the immune system. Radiation destroys the immune system. So then the person just doesn't die of cancer that radiation and chemotherapy were fighting. They die of a secondary infection, pneumonia, even diarrhea. Believe it or not, where people have so much diarrhea, they can't absorb nutrients, electrolytes are thrown out of the body, and they go into organ failure. You would think, then, that reasonable minds would suggest that now we should be eating a diet that strengthens our immune system, suggesting mushrooms like shiitake mushroom, a maitake mushroom, and reishi mushrooms. No, they don't. And miso, a fermented soybean. No. And or having in garlic and onions. No. No, outside of just some cultural taste enhancers, we don't look at these as building our immune system. But in point of fact, you're only going to live as long as your immune system allows you. So you really better pay attention to vitamin C and vitamin E and coenzyme Q10 and zinc, because these strengthen the immune system, especially zinc and vitamin C. And the foods that really help the immune system, like chlorella and spirulina, and berries like blueberries and pomegranates and dark cherries, all help the immune system. And watermelon juice with lemon and ginger all help the immune system. So those are things that can make an enormous difference in keeping our bodies strong all the time, whether we're men or women. And also from the University of Cincinnati, they did a study on blood cells, the leukocytes, and they measured the telomere, telo, T-E-L-O-mere, M-E-R-E, and the length of those in postmenopausal women. Why? Because once a woman's postmenopausal, she ages extremely rapidly. I mean, you'll see someone who is maybe 55 and now postmenopausal, and the next 5 years, it looks like she's aged 20 years, unless you're really into health. So we had better pay attention to this. So data detailed on cell research and blood cells have been presented, and according to the news reporting from Cincinnati, quote, to compare leukocyte telomere length by race and describe demographic, health, and psychosocial factors associated with this in postmenopausal women, they did this study. And the women were between 58 and 65. And what they found is the blood pressure goes up and the telomeres shorten. Now, here's the deal. If the telomeres, which are these protein end caps on chromosomes, when they shorten, your life shortens. When they lengthen, your life lengthens. So what causes them to shorten? Well, here's the top 10 reasons. So write them down, please. Stress. Stress will kill you quicker than any bad diet. It is really lethal, especially chronic stress. Lack of exercise and being sedentary. Having a diet that is high in processed foods. Processed foods, including things like French fries, hamburgers, hot dogs, those all are bad for us. Also, soft drinks. soft drinks high in high fructose corn syrup are terrible for us. Also, coffee. Believe it or not, coffee is deadly because coffee is highly anabolic. And anything that's highly anabolic is not good for you because it creates an acid base. And that's one of the common reasons we have GERD in the American diet. Also bad for us would be alcohol in any amount. Don't believe those people who are telling you, oh, you need a drink a day. I'm just wondering how many millions of Americans ended up suffering from heart attacks and stroke because they believed their doctor, who had not done their research, when we got this whole phenomenon back in the mid-1970s saying, oh, a glass of alcohol a day is good for your heart, extends your life, especially if you're a woman. Now, I knew that wasn't true because as a scientist at the Institute of Biology, I had done a lot of research on alcohol. And so much so, I wrote a book called Alcohol Nutrition. And in it, I showed how damaging alcohol is in any amount and how many brain cells, kidney cells, liver cells, and heart cells it destroys with each drink. Plus, it corrodes, really wipes out the mucous membrane in the stomach and the intestines. All right, so I want to see the truth. And to get to the truth, you can't stop at people who act as if they are the truth, the living embodiment of the truth, because they have some official pedigree after their name. So I went directly to where they said this French paradox occurred. And the idea was that the French have a lot of fatty foods in their diet, lots of cheeses and dairy and eggs and beef and pork, and yet they have a lower incidence of heart disease than people in the United States or other Western nations. So they called it the French paradox. And but they drink alcohol. Therefore, it must be the alcohol that is a preventative factor. And without doing any further research that I could find in the literature, suddenly word of mouth went out. Drink one glass. Then it went from one to two glasses. And the final straw for me was when this lawyer came into my office. And he had a lot of health problems. And when I was going through his diet, he said, no, but I've got a good diet. I mean, my cardiologist is, you know, on top of my diet. Well, tell me what your diet is. We have different interpretations of what makes a healthy diet. So when he started talking about his diet, I said, this isn't a healthy diet. Look at all the protein you have. Well, he's got me on a high-protein diet because I'm diabetic, so I have to eat protein like four times a day. I said, you're getting almost 300 grams of protein a day. You only need about 50. So you're getting an entire week's worth of protein. That's creating ammonia and nitrogen excess in your body, and you can't store that protein, so your liver and kidneys are taking a beating. And also, that's a whole lot of calories and saturated fat. Well, but, you know, he says I'm okay and I'm drinking two glasses of alcohol a day. What kind of alcohol? Bourbon. Bourbon? Bourbon's like 80% alcohol. It's like drinking rubbing alcohol. That's extremely damaging. Well, he knows best. And he left determined not to take my advice because his doctor was a leading specialist cardiologist and a professor. Hence this whole idea that we become enamored by pedigree. So that next week I flew off to France. And there I have a friend that lives in the French countryside, and I don't speak French, so he was my interpreter and he took me from village to village. And by the time I finished, I think 3 weeks there, 4 weeks, I began to realize something. That there is a French paradox, that much is correct. But it's also a Mediterranean paradox, not just France. And the healthiest people in the entire Western Mediterranean, remember you got Croatia and Macedonia and you got all these other countries on the eastern side of the Mediterranean. If you look at Italy, Italy has the Mediterranean Sea going up one side, the east side, and one side, the west side. It's only the west side's healthy. The people on the east side are not healthy at all. And the healthiest people in that part of the world, in fact, probably the healthiest people on the planet right now today, are the Italians. They have the highest the highest percentage of health compared to disease of any population in the world, even more so than the Japanese. And that's not because the Japanese are unhealthy per se, but the younger Japanese have completely foregone the traditional Japanese diet and are consuming fast food, junk food, and hence aging and having diseases at a younger age than historic to what they would. And in any case, what I saw was that at least in all the homes I was at, they didn't have hard alcohol. They had wine, organic homemade wine, very low alcohol content, like 1% or 2%. Nothing high. And it was merely, really, you know what it was? It was fermented, just like fermented apple cider vinegar, you know, or apple cider. It was not unhealthy. It was healthy. And they finished every meal with fruit. In fact, not only did they do that in France, now you could get a gourmet, wonderful dessert, you know, loaded with sugar and fat and dairy if you went into the restaurants. But I'm talking about the real lessons you learn are in the country. That's where I always go. I spend very little time on all my travels in the cities. Most is spent in the suburbs, but mainly in the country, because the country is the least adulterated, least corrupted, least converted from the old style. So that's where you learn. And that's where I was. And there was this one man, and all the people were very nice, contrary to some of the, you know, things you hear about some of the Parisians and their arrogance and conceit about how smart they are because they read Albert Camus and understand some of Nietzsche and you don't. And it's just not true. It's just one of these myths. Of course you're going to find some arrogant people. And you have no reason to go to France to find them. You can go to the New York Times, the Washington Post, any of the networks, any of the universities, and any agency of government. You can find them there too. But in any case, there's this one man, and just an ordinary house, just a normal citizen, but he loved gardening. And of course, he had this whole discussion about gardening, and they have a long growing season there because they have a nice temperature. And he had bottled 12,000 bottles of wine himself, and he gave those as gifts to his neighbors. In return, his neighbors gave him what they, and the whole community, did this fair exchange idea. Just neighbors being thoughtful. I had that down at my home when I lived down in a little tiny town of 240 people, Tioga, Texas, the Healing Springs Ranch. And I had the same phenomena there. I'd wake up in the morning, and I'd go out for my run, and there would be a bushel basket of peaches. No, just neighbors being friendly. In return, I would bale 200 acres. I had 200 acres that I grew hay on, and no sprays, and I'd bale it. And I'd put maybe 100 giant bales. Bales, you know, it's so tall, they were taller than you, and big, wide bales. And I put a sign up in the feed store, you know, help yourself to a couple bales. These are like $100. So they'd come in. They'd all be gone. And people would come and take them. And when there was a drought, no one's water was working, I opened up, you know, the gates, and they could come with water trucks and load up from my lake. And so you help one another just because that's what good people who are taught morals and manners and etiquette and have some spiritual values, that's what you do. You don't have to be reminded. You just do it as a natural thought. And needless to say, we didn't see any stealing. We didn't see the robberies because everyone was looking after everyone else. You have to go to some small towns, not the big cities, to learn how people once lived, could live, do live, and other people have forgotten about this. But when it comes to nutrition, I found the best nutrition, the healthiest lifestyles in the country. So this man was very proud of his organic garden. So I asked him, I said, well, why don't you use pesticides? He said, you're kidding me. He said, you're kidding me. They're toxic. He said, look at any time people use pesticides. They end up getting lesions and burns on their legs and their hands. Nobody here uses pesticides. The big commercial farmers might, but nobody. And the restaurateurs, they're not going to go to a place that uses commercial, you know, genetically engineered food and pesticides. No, they want the best, fresh, non-sprayed. So we think that the whole world is as dumb as we are. That's just not true. It's just not true. I travel constantly. I travel all over the world, and I travel to speak with people to see what their truth is and see if we can bring any of that into our own. And about 5 to 10% of the American population, they're not going to eat sprayed, genetically engineered food. 90% will. The vast majority will. It won't change, no matter what evidence there is, what harm is doing. But that's a much higher percentage is changed around the world, especially in Italy and in France and in Spain and Portugal. Four wonderful countries, wonderful people. And in any case, so I found that they were not eating the big sugary desserts. They didn't have a lot of the, and all their dairy was organic. And they had an enormous amount of beans and legumes and pulses in the diet. We don't. They had a great deal of mushrooms and garlic and shallots and chives. We don't. They had a tremendous amount of mushrooms. And I went into one woman's house. Again, I'm not talking about anyone who is outside the norm, just a normal neighborhood. And she had over 22 different types of mushrooms. I never had seen that many mushrooms in one person's house. And she showed how each mushroom was used differently, and there's different tastes and medicinal values. And they were all very aware that you build up your immune system by eating this way. So after my trip, I came back, and I wrote a series of articles about that it's the Mediterranean paradox is not that they use alcohol, but the alcohol they drink, like in Italy, and is wine, and more often than not, without the sulfates in it, and organic, and they finish their meal with fruit. They eat one portion at a time. They don't overeat. There's very little obesity. They do a lot of walking and exercise. They take their time when they eat. They're less stressed than we are. That's the paradox. So we're saying, too complicated. No one's going to buy it. No, no, no. Americans love for someone else to change for them. They're entertained by other people's events and exhibitionism, but they're just going to sit there and eat their, you know, whatever they're eating and drink what they're drinking and turn the channel when they're bored. So I went on a whole national campaign to get people away from drinking alcohol. I don't know if I succeeded at all. Probably not. But at least I knew the truth, and the people listening to this radio show knew the truth. And that's what's important to me. You know, the idea that somehow a truth is going to be transmorphed into the consciousness of the average person just is, it's a fallacy. You've got layer upon layer upon layer of conditioned response where people are not conditioned to something, they reject it. They have to filter everything through their truth processing, and so that means that everyone and everything that was a part of their this is the truth, nothing else is, has the first say whether it even gets into your consciousness. So as a matter of fact, most things that are important to us never get to our conscious level where we can make conscious choices, mindful choices, because it's all swept into the dustbin of this epigenetic, subconscious, maladaptive, reflexive, active mindset. Just something to think about. That's the latest on health and nutrition. We're going to take a brief break and come right back. I'm Gary Null, out on the road. And when I come back, I'll be coming back to a premiere of Plant Codes. And tomorrow I'll tell you about how lowering your homocysteine level can save you from a heart attack. But we got a lot of show to go, so please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting by telephone today instead of being in our studio because I'm on the road, completing several documentaries, the newest one, which is being very well received on PBS stations around the United States, is called Plant Codes, How Doctors Cured Themselves, board-certified Orthodox doctors, not holistic in any way. They didn't believe it would work because they tried everything their Orthodox armamentarium had for them. And then when that didn't work, they tried a plant-based diet reluctantly and hesitatingly. It worked, and they used it on their patients, and now that's a whole program. That's a feel-good film. I have some very not-feel-good films on the truth of other issues that I'm filming, I'll be sharing in the late fall. And we'll be going to my guest in a moment. This is from Dr. David King of The Guardian. Editing the human genome brings us one step closer to consumer eugenics. Quote, hijacked by the free market, human gene editing will lead to greater social inequality by heading where the money is designed. Babies. Designer babies. Quote, hope for families with genetic conditions and scientific breakthrough. That's how they're selling it. That's how they're promoting it. Well, I could think of how many times they've told us something. Let me just recall for a moment. I shared last week or 2 weeks ago with you on the air, I found a full-page article in the Journal of the American Medical Association showing how 46,000 doctors recommended Chesterfields because it soothed the throat. Well, think of how many women my mother's generation, growing up in the 1930s and 40s, believed that and smoked, thinking it was good for them. It wasn't. No one apologized for all the deaths. How many deaths? From the 1920s till now, over 20 million deaths from smoking in the United States. I can think about the first major consumer activity outside of helping ban DDT, which we started in the mid-1960s and ended in 1972 with its banning. But at the same time, there was this whole phenomenon where women were told that you could put time on your side by taking synthetic estrogen replacement therapy. It would help prevent a heart attack and help prevent a stroke and turn off hot flashes and prevent osteoporosis to boot. An average of 10 million women per day in the United States from then until now have been using this scam. In point of fact, the government's own study showed that it increases heart attack, stroke, breast cancer, ovarian cancer, colorectal cancer, and dementia by at least 13%. That means that every year we are sacrificing about 1.3 million women per year on the altar of greed, and the medical industrial complex never once raised its voice. 920,000 doctors. We, the non-medical doctors, found the evidence, presented it, and to their credit, a lot of women activists are now and have been, including Barbara Seaman, my co-author on For Women Only, have been telling women, don't use synthetic hormone replacement therapy. If you need replacement therapy, there's natural, biological, identical hormone replacement therapies that are non-harmful that can help you rebalance it. Of course, there's no profit in that, and you can't patent it. So, of course, the manufacturers and the media don't talk about what you can do naturally. But Dong Quai, Fo Tai, Passion Vine, Squall Vine, and Vitex, and a healthy diet and exercise, they go for the drugs. So I'm merely giving those as examples. I could add statins in. I could add that your kid is crazy, has brain chemical imbalance, needs Ritalin, get him to the doctor immediately. You'll have to be patient because there's 10 million other children waiting in line to see the doctor to get their diagnosis instantaneous by two symptoms. Are you distracted, Johnny? Sometimes. Oh, that's not good. And do you fidget ever in your seat? Well, the teacher's boring. No, I'm not asking about the boring. I know more than the teacher. No, that's not where. Some of the people in class are rather stupid. No, Johnny, do you ever fidget? And sometimes, Johnny, that's a brain chemical imbalance. You're on Ritalin. Thank goodness we caught it early. Now join the other 10 million children who every day have to take this drug in order to go to school. And not a word, not one syllable out of the mouths of psychiatrists, psychologists, and teachers, and principals, the entire educational system. You have allowed children to be pathologized as a profit stream for Big Pharma. And those who have spoken out have ended up in rubber rooms or criticized. Thank goodness we do have some courageous teachers, administrators, psychologists who realize that the kid doesn't have a brain chemical imbalance, and yet no generation in history has been treated with such disdain because it's a profit center. So I merely give you this as background because we have a lot of instances where people were just greedy, and I just see all over this whole genetic designer babies, who's going to be able to afford the designer baby? Because you can bet they're going to charge an awful lot. Well, look, if you want your kid to be, your son to be 6'4", and strong, and bright eyes, blue, and immune to disease, that's going to run you about $300,000. and if your daughter. And next thing you know, we're going to have these people being born in the very near future, probably the next 5 years. Because once they've opened the door, it's been open. Once the first genetically altered baby has occurred, it happened 2 weeks ago, then it's just going to be a profit stream. So what do you think about this? What do you think about what's going to happen? It is inevitable because we have a really hard time in America getting out of line. We spend our whole line being conditioned, a life being conditioned to stay in line, don't challenge authority, do what you're told, and if something's wrong, well, just sublimate with something else, but don't focus on it. So we're going to have a whole generation of babies born, and if you think the cupcake snowflakes we got up there now are bad, where do you see these coming at us? That's one thing. Secondly, microchipping humans. We told you about this 10 years ago. We showed you proof of it. And last week, we presented the man from Wisconsin on this program talking about the benefits of the computer chips, and he had more of his employees lined up to get these damn chips than he had chips available. He invented the chip, and it goes in the web of skin between your thumb and your forefinger. And why do they need these chips? Well, because it allows them to open a door automatically and allows them to open their computer automatically. That's it. What if you had information encoded in there that you didn't tell people about? Oh, we wouldn't do that. And what if you allowed the CIA to have access to that? Oh, that's never happened. You want to tell that to Google and Facebook and some of the others that have been listening in on us, and Samsung that has a little hole, go over to your television right now, take your finger across the top where that black strip is, and you'll feel a little indentation. That's a camera. That's a microphone. Now just ask yourself, if you've got that camera and microphone on you and you're in your bedroom, then someone has the capacity to watch you, film you. Do you mind? If you don't mind, if you think, I don't care, okay. But if you do care, what can you do about it outside of putting a piece of tape across it? So now the idea is we need to microchip people with no knowledge of how that microchip might impact our health. There's no tests on it. Or it could be used in ways that we would not know about. So now, quote, from Activist Post, Claire Barnish, microchipping humans. First they traded freedom for security, now it's privacy for convenience. Do we really need these? Your thoughts. I'll share mine. And finally, this is from Open Democracy, Stephen Mikulski. Gaza, 10 years of economic blockade. Supporting the DBS will hasten an end to the siege of Gaza and help launch a running lance a running sore in the Middle East and international relations. It deserves your support. The 10th anniversary of Israel's illegal blockade of the Gaza Strip has been marked by a glut of new reports from human rights organizations alerting the world to a deepening humanitarian crisis in the territory. Perhaps the starkest warning has come from the International Committee of the Red Cross in suggesting that a, quote, systematic collapse of an already battered infrastructure and economy is impending. What distinguishes this crisis from the disasters and emergencies that normally push civilian populations to the edge of catastrophic conditions is the result of hurricanes, floods, tsunamis, drought, or famine. But the calculated policy of the Israeli government, as Harvard scholar Sarah Roy, who has meticulously researched the impact of Israel's policymaking on Gaza for 30 years, suggests, quote, what is happening to Gaza is a catastrophic event. It is also deliberate and considered and purposeful. Roy argues that Gaza has been subjected to de-development, meaning that it has been, quote, dispossessed of its capacity for rational and sustainable economic growth and development, coupled with a growing inability to affect social change, end quote. So what we are witnessing in Gaza today is the, quote, illogical endpoint of this policy, the Gaza that is functionally unviable. So now people around the world are suggesting that there be boycotts of products made in Gaza, or not made in Israel, to show that we do not, as a world community, support what has happened to the Palestinian people. Where do you see this in the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, any of the MSNBC? Where do you see this anywhere in the mainstream media? You don't. When was the last time reporters like Anderson Cooper, prize himself in being, you know, so on top of stuff, when was the last time he went to Gaza and went to the West Bank and spent a week there and lived as they live, ate the food they had to eat, drink the water they have to drink, take a shower when a shower is available, and then see firsthand the conditions? Or does he stop with the propagandists? Does he stop with AIPAC? So what's your thoughts on this? Why as a society can we not come to grips with humanitarian crisis that we, the United States, support, and hence we are complicit in? Why can we not at least have a dialogue on it? And now Chuck Schumer and others want to make it illegal to talk about this at all. So what does that do to our freedoms of speech when we are no longer by law, when that comes and it is, allowed to even discuss what is happening to the Palestinians? Why? That's our talkback message. Now we're going over to my guest who's standing by, and we'll discuss his plight, his insights of what he had to go through. And on the phone with us now, and I want to thank you for being there today to talk about what you have seen in your work, and I believe what you've done is extremely courageous, and very few people would have had the courage to do what you chose to do, and that is on the line now is John Kurokawa. He's a former CIA analyst, counterterrorism operations officer, case officer, and was a senior investigator for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He was later John Kerry's intelligence advisor, and after 9/11, John was chief of counterterrorist operations in Pakistan, later becoming the executive assistant to the CIA's deputy director of operations. Later, he turned whistleblower of the CIA's torture policy practice against prisoners in custody, becoming the first government official to confirm the use of waterboarding on Al-Qaeda inmates. He was tried for passing on classified information that included the name of a fellow CIA official to a reporter and served 2 years in a federal correctional facility. The sixth indicted whistleblower by Obama, remember that real feel-good and, you know, such a charming liberal, under the Espionage Act. In fact, Obama put more people in prison or found them guilty or went after them than all other former presidents combined. No outrage on that. Nothing there to see. And what were they doing? Well, what John did. John had received 10 exceptional awards from the CIA and the State Department's Meritorious Honor Award. He has received the Joe Calloway Award for Civic Courage as a National Security Whistleblower. And in 2013, the Peacemaker of the Year Award from the Justice Center. In 2016, the Sam Adams Award, among others. He has written several books, including The Reluctant Spy, My Secret Life in the CIA's War on Terror, and more recently, Doing Time Like a Spy, How the CIA Taught Me to Survive and Thrive in Prison. His website is John Ospel Kurokawa, KIRIAKOU.com. Nice to have you with us today, John.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
John, I'd like you to begin with your own experience as a whistleblower, and obviously whistleblowing is an act of an awakened conscience. I would call it an act of outrage rather than rage. Rage is personal. Outrage is impersonal because it is directed against human dignity and decency. I feel rage against someone who does not honor any good relationship and acts badly towards me. That's my right. But if I read about Saudis killing innocent women and children and throwing gays off buildings and beheading people for watching what they didn't want on the internet or demonstrating or killing children by the thousands in Yemen with American bombs blessed by Washington, I feel outrage as if the universe has been violated, and I experience that within me. So what was it ethically you felt that compelled you to whistleblow on the CIA's use of torture? And then second, although you were tried and indicted and served prison time, what happened to those who really committed the crimes of torture on prisoners and the system that allowed it to occur and enabled those did anything ever happen to any of those people who were the real villains? The forum is yours. Well, take your time.
That's really the saddest part of this whole story, is that literally nothing happened to the torturer, and not torturers, plural, not just the torturers, but nothing happened to the CIA officials who created the torture program, who implemented the torture program, who oversaw it. Nothing happened to the attorneys who used specious legal arguments to justify it. And most importantly, nothing ever happened to the CIA officers who actually killed prisoners in custody. You know, we don't really talk about that. But there were people who were actually killed while the CIA was using these various so-called techniques on them. You know, I wish I could tell you that I was so outraged when I first learned of the torture program that I spoke out immediately. I did not speak out immediately. I kept my mouth shut for a long time. And, you know, I just got to the point where I literally could not stand the lies anymore. President Bush, at one point in December of 2007, gave a press conference in which he said, he looked right into the camera and said, "We do not torture." And I said to my wife, who was also a senior CIA officer at the time, I said, "He is a bald-faced liar. He's looking the American people in the eyes, and he's lying right to us." And then a few days later, in response to a reporter's question, he said that, well, if there is torture, it's the result of a rogue CIA officer. And I knew that was a lie. And so I decided to accept an invitation from Brian Ross of ABC News to go on to the program and to talk about the torture program. And I decided that no matter what Brian Ross asked me, that I would tell the truth. And so that's what I did. I said three things in that interview. I said that the CIA was torturing its prisoners. I said that torture was official U.S. government policy. It was not the result of a rogue, as the president had said. And I said that the torture program had been personally approved by the president himself.
All right. Let me look at the larger picture. If we pull back from a moment, we have not had that many whistleblowers in the United States. And yet, the United States government does not in and of itself recognize your rights as a whistleblower. If you're in private industry, it does. Why is it that the government, the United States, the House and the Senate and the executive branch not recognize that any employee of the government that sees the government, not a private contractor, the government committing a crime, has a moral responsibility to bring to the government's attention and the government to act on that? Why is everything that seems to be done wrong inside the government, no matter who the contractors are, you know, any of the major defense contractors, et cetera, they seem to get away with it. And yet the person that wants to bring this to someone's attention is always held up for scrutiny, scorn, and punishment.
And there's the rub. We have something called a whistleblower protection law in this country. Unfortunately, Congress, in its infinite wisdom, decided to exempt national security whistleblowers from its coverage. So if you work for the CIA, NSA, FBI, DOD, and you witness waste, fraud, abuse, or illegality, you'd better keep your mouth shut if you want to continue on in your career. If you decide to blow the whistle, there's certainly a chain of command. You go to your supervisor, and if you don't get satisfaction there, you go to the general counsel and then to the inspector general. And if you still aren't satisfied, you can go to the congressional oversight committees. But people like Tom Drake and Bill Binney from NSA and Kirk Wiebe from NSA did that. And Tom Drake, for one, was charged with 9 felonies, including 7 counts of espionage. And that was for reporting waste, fraud, abuse, and illegality to the appropriate Congressional Oversight Committee. With that said, even if you're not in the intelligence community and your interests are supposed to be protected by this whistleblower protection law, frequently they're not. There was a banking whistleblower by the name of Brad Birkenfeld, who was a senior executive at UBS in Switzerland. he noticed that American, very wealthy Americans were sending millions and millions of dollars to UBS and depositing this money in numbered accounts, and UBS was not reporting the deposits to the Treasury Department. And so what this was just a very high-end game of money laundering. And so Brad came back to the United States, took a vacation time, and came back to the United States and reported this illegality to the Treasury Department. The Treasury Department then took his information and sent it to the Justice Department. And what did the Justice Department do? They charged Brad with violating banking secrecy laws. And he ended up serving 3.5 years in a federal prison. Now, it was Brad who single-handedly brought down secret Swiss banking. And in the end, the federal government had to pay him a settlement of $104 million, but not until after sending him to prison for 3.5 years.
Isn't that rather absurd? How do you as an individual reconcile the sacrifice that you make? Because I know it's got to be constantly there. You made a sacrifice. Three things should have happened in a really ethical society. First, the major media should have been on your side by showing that this is not an isolated incidence of torture that was illegal. The people doing it were, but who taught them how to do it? What members of the American Psychological Association, and there were members of the American Psychological Association, psychologists who were members of that, who did this? What does it tell us about them? Why aren't we investigating their backgrounds? How can you justify that? We also should have had investigations into the people higher up on the scale who authorized it within the agencies. Now, agencies are frequently, as you are certainly more aware than I am, they are aware of what's going on. Like the National Security Agency at the very high end will know what's going on in different departments of other agencies. It's not like every single one of these 17 agencies all operate completely autonomously and independent of one another.
Correct.
So a lot of people had to know that we were spying illegally on people. We were eavesdropping on their phones and downloading not just the date that they call someone, the phone number, but the actual content. We've been lied to nonstop by everyone who's gotten up, including Clapper got up. And did he not raise his hand and out-and-out lie and commit perjury? Have you heard a single person in the media say, shouldn't he be indicted for perjury? And yet this is what I'm seeing, that you're one of those few people with Benny and some of the others, and ones who weren't indicted, but Ray McGovern, who's spoken out, and a few more, who see what's wrong. And nothing is changing. The government's not changing it. The people sit on those oversight committees. My final question to you is, look at the two government intelligence committees, because you've been in a position to provide them with information through the people that you work for. These are the members of the Senate, and these are members of the House intelligence oversight committees that are supposed to be watching, communicating, on top of anything these intelligence agencies are doing to make sure they do not cross a boundary into illegalities or against the Constitution, and not a single one of those clowns have come forward in the entire history that they've been in existence and said, I'm going to tell the American public what's going on. And they say, well, I can't because, you know, I'm bound by a law. Well, what's more important, telling the truth to the American public or breaking a law and willing to accept that maybe there's an American public who would be behind you if you do break the law, if you're doing it so the American public can be informed? Your thoughts, please.
You're so right. I had occasion a week ago to confront a Democratic senator who has been outspoken on these issues publicly, but privately has refused to help me or any other national security whistleblower. And I told him to his face, shame on you, because you turned out to be a show horse and not a workhorse. And his response was just priceless. He said, I can't help you or anybody else. It takes all of my energy just to not lose my security clearance. And I thought, shame on you. And that's really the attitude that we get from those of us, those politicians on Capitol Hill who are supposed to be supporting us. So there's really, you know, I've come to the conclusion that the oversight committees really are not oversight committees. They're cheerleading committees. And where they're supposed to question the CIA and its covert action programs, for example, it doesn't. It approves the budget. It approves the covert action plans. It eggs them on. And then they all sit around and congratulate each other on what a great job they do. That's not what the intelligence committees were created to do. What we need is another Frank Church or another Otis Pike who's going to take these issues seriously. Certainly Dianne Feinstein was probably the CIA's best friend on Capitol Hill when she was the chairman of the Intelligence Committee. And Richard Burr now, you know, never saw a CIA program that that he didn't love and want to expand. So that's Capitol Hill. Now, in terms of other whistleblowers, you do raise another good point, and that is that nobody else came forward. I really believed, naively as it turns out, that when I went public on torture, other CIA officers, whether past or present, would do the same. I thought that the program was not just a moral and ethical abomination, but it was clearly illegal. We have the Federal Torture Act of 1946, which specifically bans the techniques that were being used by the CIA against al-Qaeda prisoners. We're also signatories, and not just signatories, but we were the primary drafters of the United Nations Convention Against Torture, which has the force of law in the United States because we're signatories to it. And I was disappointed that literally nobody else went public. We know now from the Senate Torture Report that there were people inside the CIA who were complaining about this torture program, and indeed several of them curtailed their positions, which means they asked to return to headquarters. It's a career-ending move. But even still, not a single one of them went public. And that will always be a great disappointment to me. On the other hand, and this is where I get my own strength, I know in my heart that I'm on the right side of history. We're going to look back on this 50 years from now, and our children are going to be shocked that we had a torture program and we sat idly by while employees of the American government tortured and murdered people who had never even been formally accused of a crime.
Well, I appreciate you sharing this. Of course, this is the same Dianne Feinstein who had to confront the idea that the CIA was then caught spying on members of the Intelligence Committee itself, which is a felony. You're not allowed to spy if you're with the CIA. You're not allowed to go on and download information off people's computers and put spyware in there. Not a single thing happened to a single person because of that.
No, and it goes to show you the level of respect that John Brennan had for Dianne Feinstein.
Well, this is where we find ourselves. Would John, you have a forum here anytime you have anything relevant to share, because we do speak truth to power every day.
You do indeed. Yeah. You do. Thank you very much. And I enjoy this show very much because it is unique, really, in the American media, not just the alternative media, but any American media. We should all be talking about these issues, and we're not. So thank you for doing that.
John, we look forward to another conversation. All the best to you.
Thank you, and to you.
And that is a gentleman we should all pay attention to because he made the sacrifice. He went to prison for telling the truth and telling us what we needed to know. And yet we wouldn't know that by the American media and how he has been treated. John Caracalla. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. I have a powerful show tonight on the 7 o'clock. You're going to know the truth about who was behind setting up Sirhan Sirhan, the group, and how it was not Sirhan. Sirhan is a lone assassin, as history has been told, and we have one of the best constitutional lawyers and investigative lawyers in America, in America's history, who's going to be the guest. So join us tonight, 7 p.m., Progressive Commentary Hour. Have a nice day, everyone.
Keep on pushing. Keep on pushing. I've got to keep on pushing. Mm-hmm. I can't stop now.